This podcast is a Majestic Giraffe production. For more information and more content, visit majesticgiraffe.com.
But I was going into Toshi Station to pick up some power converters.
Droids are clean, the vaporizers are patched, and the speeders fuel. It's time to pick up some blue milk and power converters. You're listening to Toshi Station Radio, brought to you by the Majestic Giraffe Network. Now here are your hosts for the Snarkiest Podcast in Star Wars and Geek Culture, Brian and Nancy.
Outskirts of Anchorhead and on the shores of the Great Chat Flats, you're listening to Toshi Station Radio, the bright center in the universe for all things Star Wars and geek culture. I'm your host, Brian, and with me, as always, is my co-host and fiancé, Nancy.
Hi.
On today's episode, we've got something special lined up for you. It's an interview with John Jackson Miller to discuss Kenobi, the latest in the Expanded Universe Library. So sit back, grab some power converters, and enjoy the show. Nancy, you sound tired.
I am. I'm very tired.
And why is that?
Because we just got back from a Disney cruise.
And all of our listeners are now very jealous of us.
Yes, probably.
But yes, we had a good time on a Disney cruise. Had some family in town, did a little bit of vacationing, and today we're just putting together an interview we recorded a couple weeks ago with John Jackson Miller, so it's going to be a slightly different episode than usual, because we're not going to do Fixer's Flash, we're not going to do Deke's Dirt, we're just going to jump straight into this interview, and we hope you enjoy it. We had a lot of fun with it. Bria.
Yes.
Bria joined us for this, so you'll get to listen to the three of us and John Jackson Miller in just a moment.
And you said this warning many times, actually, during the interview, but we will warn you again now. It is spoiler-filled.
There are spoilers everywhere in this interview. We wanted to have a deep discussion on this, so if you proceed any further, it's your own fault.
Yep.
If you haven't read the book yet, there are spoilers.
Many spoilers.
Many, 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 many spoilers.
And I will highly recommend reading this book unspoiled because it's that good.
It is that good. We loved it to pieces. You can tell by our go-no-go segment and the reviews we've got up on the blog. Links in the show notes.
I will say it's probably my favorite EU book from the past several years.
Yeah, great. It was fantastic. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I heartily recommend it to you. So if you're going to back out of this podcast episode because you haven't read the book yet or because you don't want to be spoiled, let me just say, go get the book right now.
And then after you read it, come back and listen to the podcast.
Yes, because John Jackson Miller had a ton of great insight.
He did.
That went into the book. One of my favorite interviews we've done on the show.
And it lasted a long time.
Which is why we're not doing any of the other segments today.
Well, I guess we did a mini Fixer's Flash.
Yeah, we did a mini Fixer's Flash.
And I will say, if you are a Disney fan, now that we're all part of the Disney family here with Star Wars, you should try a Disney cruise.
You really should. We enjoyed ours so much that we booked another one while we were on board.
We did. We didn't get suckered into the vacation club, as we live right near Disney World, but we did buy another cruise. We're okay with that decision.
That we are.
Yeah.
So without further ado, here is our interview with John Jackson Miller. We will see you on the other side.
All right, we're here with John Jackson Miller, Star Wars author, and just to start off right off the bat, we will be spoiling Kenobi. So if you have not yet read Kenobi, turn off the podcast, go read it, and then come back and listen to it. And don't say we didn't warn you. So, John, we always start our interviews with the same question. How did you become a Star Wars fan?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think it was entirely you're backwards, because I didn't get to see the movie for a good long while. I was 9 years old, and I knew that the other kids were talking about something. You know, there was a kid down the road talking about this movie, and it had this character in it, Darth Vader, and I responded to him, "No, you mean Dark Invader. You've got a lisp. You're 8 years old. You don't mean Darth Vader. That just doesn't make any sense. What's a Darth Vader?" And I didn't actually get in to see the movie for a long time because that was in the days before the multiplexes. And, you know, a theater would get a copy of the film and none of the other theaters around would get it. And they would have it in one room. And, you know, that's how that whole dynamic of the lines going around the block really got started with the blockbusters there in the 70s. And I ended up reading the comic book adaptation first, the three-pack that was done by Western Publishing, reprinting the Marvel adaptation, the first three issues. I read those three issues, and that's a fun bit about Kenobi is there's a cameo appearance character from one of those three issues, which we'll get to in a while. I ended up reading that and finally the entire comics adaptation before we got in to see the movie. My sister, who, you know, was valiantly trying to get me into this movie, she's several years older than I am, you know, would take me to the theater and we would see Pete's Dragon or something that, yeah, I have never forgiven Helen Reddy ever since. I just, you know, was very upset because I knew I needed to see this thing. And, you know, finally we got in and Kenobi is, in fact, dedicated to my sister for making sure that I got in to see the movie. And it sort of went from there. I mean, she would be filtering me all the stuff that came out. She gave me a copy of Splinter of the Mind's Eye that I still have, and I got Alan Dean Foster to sign it later on. You know, we didn't know whether it was the next Star Wars movie or not, but that was the rumor at the time. And you know, she and my mother got me all the action figures and things like that. So I had all of that stuff that was there, you know, supporting the movie. It took a while to actually get in to see the movie. And I'm glad that I finally did. And, you know, by the time we get to Return of the Jedi, you know, my sister took me again. But, you know, this time it was me and my friends from middle school sitting front row center at that showing. And I've got to say, I learned then that front row center is not really a good place to see a movie from. Concert, fine. Comedy show, you know, that's okay. Maybe the comedian will call you out and pick on you. You know, Jay Leno did that to me once, for real. So front row's not always great. And definitely in a movie theater, you know, you're going to break your neck. But that was a packed house. And, you know, the audience actually stood at the end when Darth Vader was making his big decision and was cheering. And it must have. I've never seen anything like that. And it absolutely must have made the people in the theater next door wonder what the heck was going on.
At Celebration 6, Celebration 5, I went and watched some of the movies. And during that part in Return of the Jedi, everyone stood up and clapped. After Anakin can kill the Emperor, and I got a little teary eyed. I'm like, oh, I love Star Wars fans.
It was absolutely surreal, and I've never seen anything like that. I think not really until I went to see the premiere of Batman, I guess, 6 years later, and that was the first time that I had seen people showing up in costume, at the movie theater, and you know, having the capes and the makeup and everything. You know, I realized, all right. This has gone from just what used to be a simple entertainment experience to, a phenomenon.
So when did you start writing in general, and when did you realize you wanted that to be your profession?
Well, as far as writing, I mean, I started writing my own comics at the same time I started collecting them. The running joke we have, my mother is a grade school librarian, or was for many years, and where other people's mothers threw their comics away, my mother encouraged me to put mine in order. And of course, that ended up working out pretty well with what I ended up later doing, which was, you know, writing for comic book price guides, where, you know, we were encouraging everybody to put their comics in order and you know, teaching them ways to store them and that sort of thing. So yeah, I was doing my own comics just on notebook paper folded over, and you know, I think my first science fiction character I created at age 6, his name was Space Tracer, and like every character, yeah, he's got a rhyme. The name has got a rhyme, and it was basically just a kid, me or whoever, you know, puttering around the solar system in this ludicrous spaceship. And of course, you know, by the time Star Wars came around, yeah, I think I was 9 years old at that point, I decided, well, now it's time for me to make the Space Tracer movie. And I did this thing where it was actually, you know, the storyboards for the movie, but I had it, I had made my own movie screen out of a shoebox and some, you know, some, I guess, rolls of wrapping paper and a long sheet of paper rolled around it, where, you know, you would turn the dowel and you'd see the next frame. And yeah, I did my own story that way. And I don't know what it was, but I always thought that it was just normal for people who were consuming entertainment to try to create their own. And I think that is really a strength of comics. I've said this, you know, many times, particularly over on Comicron, which is my my website that I do, which is a comics history site, that comics are fairly alone in the entertainment world in the sense that everybody who consumes them or everybody who reads them also wants to do their own. You know, it. I guess maybe music is close to it, you know, people with their own garage bands. But, you know, to be sure, you don't really have people watch football, NFL on TV, fans of that, immediately go put on pads and you know, beat each other up in the parking lot. It's just not the same thing. You know, everybody who reads comics wants to participate in some way, shape, or form in the field. And I think the wonderful thing of, you know, certainly the 1980s and 90s was that with the direct market, it became possible for, you know, more people to create their own comics. It became possible for people to make a living selling comics if they, you know, didn't really have the creative interest, but they wanted to still participate in the field. You know, there are just all these points of entry that opened up. And then the internet made it even, you know, more possible to do that. Yeah, I mean, I started doing these little, you know, comic books on notebook paper that later on, you know, I moved on to the photocopier and being part of the whole mini comics experience that was out there, people sending back and forth, you know, these magazines to other people. But, you know, if I were growing up today, I'd be doing a webcomic. I, instead of doing the fanzines that I was doing, I would be doing a blog. So yeah, I think there's just so many ways to get involved, and you know, I think back then I felt like I had to make up my own ways to get involved, and it turns out I wasn't alone. There were a lot of other people doing the same thing.
Cool. Well, so you've obviously been writing for a long time. How did you get involved writing for Star Wars?
Well, I once I got into the professional world, I was trained as a journalist. I was the editor of the trade magazine for the comics industry for most of the 90s. And in the early 2000s, I got the opportunity to write for Marvel. I did a couple of series there, Crimson Dynamo, and then Iron Man, which I wrote for a year. Because I was in the business and knew people, and I know that sounds terrible. I was in the business and I knew people, but it really, you know, to a degree, at least, it does help to, you know who the submission person is, for example, at a particular publishing company or something like that. In my case, I actually dropped by Dark Horse's offices. I set up an appointment. But I knew the folks there because I had been, you know, working with them for about 10, 11 years, you know, in the media side of things. And, you know, I did a tour over there, and I met the folks producing the comics, and I saw how they made them. And it just so happened that, you know, the last stop on that tour, I was able to go say hi to Randy Stradley, the editor of The Line, and find out that, yeah, actually there was a slot that was available, a fill-in issue that needed to be done for Star Wars Empire. And, you know, I, again, just had done Iron Man and a Simpsons book earlier that summer. And I said, hey, well, let me pitch something. And that ended up being Star Wars Empire number 35. That's the only Darth Vader story that I've done to date. It's actually the latest thing in the continuity I have ever done, ironically. It was the very first thing I ever did. And then that led to the chance to write Knights of the Old Republic. And that led to Knight Errant and writing prose and Lost Tribe of the Sith and now to Kenobi.
So we just want to talk about the KOTOR comics a little bit. What was it like having the chance to flesh out that world and in some cases the characters from the games?
Well, the funny thing is that, you know, when they approached me, they said, completely don't look at the games before you come up with your concept. You want to have a story that's appealing and characters that are appealing. Then we'll figure out how it fits into everything. It very well could have been that we could have put that story in between the first and second game, for example, or some other time. The Knights of the Old Republic, you know, basically, you know, that corner of the universe really was regarded to be, you know, the 50 years or so between the Tales of the Jedi comics in the beginning of the 4000, you know, BBY period, all the way through to the events of the second game. So all of that real estate was open to possibly put the story into. And what I was interested in writing about was, again, this fugitive story about a Jedi who was on the run from his own teachers. And it struck me that the best possible place to put that, timeline-wise, was in the years before the first video game, in the years before the so-called Jedi Civil War, and, you know, really play on the paranoia of this particular sect of Jedi, this group that believes that something bad is coming for the galaxy. And, of course, the reader, if they played the games, they know something bad is coming for the galaxy. They just, you know, unfortunately, the you know, Zane Carrick's masters did not have the opportunity to play the Knights of the Old Republic video game beforehand and see just how wrong they were about this kid. But I felt that that was a fun dynamic that we were able to generate there, playing with, I think, you know, with the prequel movies, you knew where the destination was. It was all about how you got there. And in this case, it was similar to that, but we didn't, you know, there were a lot of blanks that were still out there left to be filled in. And, you know, the way that we came at it, we weren't there to fill in blanks anyway. You know, we weren't there to tell you, you know, what Revan's proper name was. We did eventually, you know, do his origin story, but that was not really the point of the series. It was really more about the base, you know, basic characters.
That actually leads pretty well into my next question, which I'm sorry, I have to ask it. I love how you made it so that Malik's first name was originally Alec, because who is going to name their kid Malik? But
yeah.
Where the heck did his last name /village come from?
If I could get that thing out of continuity, I would be thrilled about it. I have worked on it several times with the Wikipedia guys. The only person who ever really gave me a lot of flack about it was the guy trying to put the names on the miniatures out at Wizards of the Coast. The idea behind Alec was it was going to be something that there were a number of mysteries in the KOTOR series where the only characters who weren't supposed to know the correct identity of somebody were really the characters in the books. The fans would know at some point. For example, the whole business with you know, Demogal and who Demogal was. Well, I won't spoil that. But that was one of those things where we realized that the story wasn't, the mystery wasn't going to be, you know, who he was pretending to be. The mystery was going to be why he was doing that. And we eventually, you know, pushed it more towards that direction. With Malik, it was one of those things where, you know, we continually wanted to have this door open to you know, make it possible that the reader out there would say, well, maybe he isn't Malik. Well, maybe he's not that person. And so, you know, there was a about a 2-week window, and it was really only supposed to be that 2-week window where, you know, the red herring of the last name, and that last name really was out there to sort of be, oh God, they can't be really intending to name him Squinscork Jessimus or whatever it was going to be. It can't be that. And I can't remember how long it was supposed to originally be in continuity. It was very brief. It only appeared in my writing in the Knights of the Old Republic campaign guide. And the plan was, that was it. I'm remembering now. We were going to get it out of the picture pretty quickly. But what ended up happening is we ended up having the Vector series, which showed up. And I wasn't able to get to that story immediately. And what happened is another book came out in the Star Wars Expanded Universe. I think it was Jedi versus Sith, not Jedi versus, Jedi and Sith, The Essential Guide to the Force. And in that case, the editors went to Lucasfilm and said, well, what is this character's current name? And that's what got picked up. And I saw it, and when I saw it, I went, no, 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 this was not supposed to go that way. It also ended up sort of outing the fact that Alec was Malik. But again, that was one of those things where it was really not intended to be the real mystery. It was going to be more about how he got there. I really wish I hadn't put it in. But that's the sort of thing that happens sometimes. So you live and you learn. But yeah, I think we got that completely out, and we explained, as I intended to all along, that that was never his real name, that that was just an erroneous, you know, listing on his immigration forms to the Republic. yeah, these are the things that if you write long enough, something like that's going to happen. And yeah, so let's just delete the last 15 minutes. That'll make me happy.
Well, it does make it fun because when you play the games, I yell Darth Squiggly Pants now because I can never remember the full name.
Oh, that's great. No, I do, like I say, I do apologize to everybody who's more confused than they needed to be, because it was I was throwing red herrings a lot with our mysteries back then, and that was a fish too far.
So for KOTOR and for Knight Errant, it looks, from what I remember, you worked with multiple pencilers throughout the different arcs. Did you ever have to like adjust your writing style depending on who's drawing the issue to try and to work to one artist's strengths or another?
Oh, yeah. Well, we tried, but again, one of the problems was you didn't always know exactly how it was going to, you know, work out. In that whole days, nights sequence that we did, that was the second year of the series, where it was 4 3-issue arcs, one after the other after the other. The whole idea behind that was that we were going to have alternating artists do 3 issues each. Brian Ching was going to do the first 3, Dustin Weaver was going to do the second 3, and then we would alternate. And Brian's strength is really, you know, the figure work, the characters, the costumes, and whereas I think Dustin really was much more into architecture. He was, you know, designing really wonderful spaceship bridges and that sort of thing. And so the way that I worked it out was that it was going to end up being, you know, the character specific portions of it we're going to land in Brian's section, and then the really technical, lots of ships and everything, that was going to wind up with Dustin. That entire timeline of who was supposed to draw when completely collapsed very early. And so by the time we get to the end of that series, I think we had an arc that was, I can't remember which order they were supposed to go in, but, by the end, Dustin was doing Brian's arc, and it was still really good. And cause these guys are great artists. But I'm not sure they were drawing the stuff they exactly intended to, or, wanted to draw in the beginning. I did my best to give them what they wanted, but I just didn't get the right people at the right time. It is something where you realize that this particular artist excels in this kind of work, you do try to write to their strengths.
Okay, this next one's getting a little bit into the book, but it's something I really noticed when I was flipping through the KOTOR comics I have before this interview. So we talk a lot about diversity on the blog, and I just sort of noticed it seems to be a theme in your work, judging by the comic series and then with Kenobi. Is that a conscious choice that you make, or is it something that just sort of naturally happens?
Well, I mean, I think the sandbox that you're working in really kind of sets up what the cultural norms or biases are that you're going to have to confront and deal with. We're in Star Wars where, the question is not whether someone is black or white when green and purple are options for skin color. There are all sorts of cultural issues that are not in play. On the other hand, there are different cultural issues that are specific to that particular milieu, such as the Athorians not liking being called hammerheads, various things that you kind of want to try to know. I think whenever I'm approaching a story, I look at it and say, is there a reason this character can't be female that is endemic to this this universe? And it's not really that I am trying to have an equal numbers in there. There's never a quota or anything like that. It's just it's my natural working style to try and make things feel as much like life would be in that particular realm. I mean, if we were talking about writing a Napoleonic era, war novel, then there would be different gender roles and different things to be concerned about culturally. But this is Star Wars, and this is not a world in which there ever was slavery of the kind that we had in this country. This is a world that has had slavery, though, of a different type, and you have to be aware of that. This is a world in which certain kinds of biases have not existed, but droids, we don't want your kind in here. That's something you want to be mindful of. I think also, even so, all of that said, you also, I think, look at the characters' roles and look at those as explaining, what kinds of responses they might have to things. We have, one of the major characters in Kenobi is a single mom. It could easily be a single dad. And in fact, there is a single dad in the story, too. And we see that they both have different responses to their roles. And I don't think that those are gender-based necessarily. I think that they can be, if you, have somebody who's, been in a relationship where they've been the only caregiver for that long time, but I think, anyway, I'm rambling a bit here, but I guess what I'm trying to say here is that particularly when we're talking about Star Wars, I think that you err on the side of inclusivity. You usually wind up with what should be a fairly balanced cast, whatever you're doing, unless there is a story-related or universe-related reason why things are the way they are. We deal, for example, with the Tusken Raiders in this. There were a number of things about the Tusken Raiders society, gender-wise, that were established before I got there. And even so, I think we played a little bit with the norms of the society and told, a new kind of story.
So you just made a good segue into some of the questions we wanted to get into about Kenobi. Specifically, was there any research you had to kind of do in order to write from a point of view of a Tusken Raider?
Yeah, that was something that, back when we started this, I think I've mentioned a number of places now that this began as a graphic novel concept for Dark Horse that I started working on in 2006. I got through a couple of drafts, three drafts actually, and we ended up not sending it to Lucasfilm because I got the Indiana Jones book instead. And also, it became clear to me that enough of this story was internal, that it was better done as a novel. It was also a sprawling story by that point, and we didn't think it would fit. I did quite a lot of research looking at what was going on with Obi-Wan Kenobi during that intermovie period. What was happening on Tatooine in that intermovie period, and what was happening with the Tusken Raiders both in that period and also before. We wanted very much not to step on anybody's toes, and I think in the beginning, my greatest worry was that we wouldn't be able to even write in this time period with Obi-Wan. Because if you'll remember, 2007 is when they started talking about doing the movie, not the movie, I said the TV series, the live-action TV series that was floated. I think it's Celebration 4 was when the news came out about that. That was around the time where we said, okay, I'm not sure we're even going to be able to do this. But one of the things, for example, that I needed to be aware of was there was incoming continuity from Star Wars Legacy. Because it had not released yet, but Ben Kenobi has that encounter with Darth Krayt in this intermovie period. It was actually while I was working on one of those drafts that I was alerted, okay, we need to make sure that we know where your story is related to this thing here. I studied up on that. And then, of course, I also studied up on just how these things had been presented in the past. The Tuskens, a big story that was helpful was Tim Truman's Outlander, which appeared in one of the early Star Wars Republic arcs, I think it was, which was, coincidentally or not coincidentally, about Sharad Het, who was Asharad's father. And that showed me a lot about, what the cultural norms were for this group to the extent that they had them. And then I dug into a lot of the other source material that was out there and basically saw, okay, well, what are my constraints? What are the things that are going to limit what I can do here? And so when we came to the time of actually, I had actually not developed a Yark, the Tusken chief, in the story until the character was present in the early drafts, but a lot of the characters, the character's gender, for example, I had not decided on that back 6 years ago. But once I read all the supporting material that was around, I realized, okay, this is a story that has not been told, and it's a story that can be told because somebody along the way in one of those supporting documents had set up that there was a gender role system within the Tuscans, or at least within certain tribes of the Tuscans, that was not going to be present any place else in Star Wars I was writing about, unless I was writing about, you know, a specific handful of species like the Deferonians, where there are different male and female gender roles that have cultural implications. It was something where I said, okay, you know what? I can tell a story here where, you know, I can play with the, you know, the reader's expectations to a degree, you know, from the past stories that they've seen about, you know, native warlords or something like that. And then I can take it a little bit in a different direction and get people thinking about something else and get people realizing that, you know, in the end, and of course, now we're in spoiler territory, you know, Annalene and Ayark are both mothers. And in fact, every major character in this series is a parent slash guardian, not just of an individual child or children of their own. You know, even Ben is Luke's guardian, but they're also the matriarch or patriarch or parents of a much larger family, and they feel like they have a much larger group of people relying on them. And of course, you know, Ben's got the largest family of all because he really thinks the whole galaxy is depending on him.
Well, you actually answered one of the questions we had about developing Ayark, and that was one of the moments where I had to put the book down and go, wow.
Well, it was a challenge because I, you know, try writing 50,000 words without a female or male pronoun.
That was actually part of that question was how did, because I had to write massage. And I don't know how you could do that.
Here's how. Because I started off by relying on a cliched trope that anybody who's reading it would probably go, oh, this is just a cliched native, where I refer to her as the chieftain or the warrior or a Yark, constantly in the third person. A Yark knew this, a Yark knew that. And since there was no other Tusken Raider around, and because we've never seen, except for I think a short story that was in, you know, one of the old adventure journals, we've never seen a Tusken Raider written from, you know, first person or from that, you know, a Tusken's point of view. You know, we didn't know, or we don't know that that's just not how we just, you know, maybe all Tuskens get referred to sort of asexually like this, without you know, he or she everywhere. But then also I went through and I tried to make it. You know, that can get really stilted. And so I had to go through and really thin out a lot of the lines where it was like, okay, this is just too much. Is there a way that I can have a Yark not, you know, have this line not be self-referential and have it be set on somebody else? And there is that level of, you know, I hate to say craft to it, but there's that level of you know, sweat that we put into making sure that, you know, not a single pronoun got through. And in fact, there was actually a sweep, you know, one of the sweeps by a proofreader, the pronouns got put back in. It's not like they were ever in, but a couple of lines that had to get rewritten. You know, I think there was a proofreader in there somewhere that rewrote the lines and put in a he, and I'm like, okay, no, we're taking that out. But again, even then, you know, I don't know that this is necessarily, you know, a story about gender. Even once we get through all of this, I think it's more a story of, you know, somebody's got to step up. You know, the Tuskens begin this novel in almost as bad a shape as the Republic. Not as bad, but, you know, they're a mess. They're dying out. And, you know, it takes a good person, the right person, to do the right thing. Annalene, same situation. steps up to do the right thing, the responsible thing. A Yark ends up doing the same thing as well. Although, you know, again, I will say that while I did trade on, you know, sort of the established cliches, and I sort of tweaked them and used them a bit to be able to get a Yark established, and then to be able to describe her just in the storyline. I think that I did try hard to keep from slipping into something that really would be cliched. They talk about the noble savage stories where it's automatic that the lesser advanced society is morally superior. There is nothing morally superior about the Tusken Raiders. They are not sympathetic. They are pathetic. But we understand to a degree why they are the way they are now, I hope. But that does not mean necessarily that they're right. And Ben remarks on that later. Just because they're doing what they have to do, you are not obligated to stand in the way or sacrifice yourself to what they're going through. We did go and we established a number of things about the Tuscans' mythology, why it is that they feel that they have to live in this place. And of course, the person who reads really closely can see the connection between the Tusken mythology and the story of Ben and Anakin. You don't have to read too closely; it's right there. I really tried to make it so that they weren't automatically you wouldn't read them and say they're the superior culture morally or inferior. They just are. And that kind of is the case with everybody. We all just are.
So for a book titled Kenobi, we didn't actually get to see much of Obi-Wan's point of view. While it and I will say it obviously worked really, really well that you wrote it that way. But I'm curious as to why you chose to write it mostly from Annalene, Oren, and Ayark's perspectives.
That was in it from the beginning. That was always the intention. As I've said, when we started, it was my former editor at Dark Horse and I were kicking around various things that just hadn't been done yet for Star Wars, for a possible original graphic novel. We got discussing westerns, and we were both fans of the movie Shane. Shane is the really, really outstanding movie based on the novel about a Western gunslinger who retires or tries to retire to a small farming community in Wyoming, but unfortunately he moves right into the what was known as the Johnson County War, which was a war between the ranchers and the farmers, which was a real event actually, and eventually has to come to terms with who he is and what his responsibilities are. Obviously, the story that we're telling is got a lot more things going on, but certainly that feeling was there. There are a lot of these Westerns where it's about the guy who's come back from the Civil War, or the guy who's trying to get out of the game, Unforgiven. Shows like that, stories like that, where it becomes an interaction between the individual who we suspect things about, and the locals who are studying him and trying to figure out how he fits into their picture and how he fits into their community. And I thought there was absolutely nobody better than Obi-Wan Kenobi to play the mystery man in these other people's lives. The story is about him, but it is also about them and how he affects them and their lives, and to a degree how they affect him and the choices he has to make when he's moving out here. The real challenge he's facing is certainly he's in pain to a great degree over the horrible things that have happened to the Republic. He's in pain over what he perceives he has done, killing his best friend. And you know, he is also, and this novel is to a great degree about this, he is feeling the loss of all of his friends and family in the Jedi Order, and the collapse of everything that he once knew. And what I wanted to do was you know, illustrate that, but also illustrate the other problem that he was going to be having, which is physics. An object in motion tends to remain in motion. This is a guy who for 20 years has been running around, playing Jedi, saving people, doing the right thing, getting immediate gratification for having done exactly that, for responding to situations the way that his heart and the Force tells him to. And now, Jedi are supposed to be prepared for any assignment. But he's never gotten an assignment that said, all right, we need you to go hide in the middle of nowhere for an indefinite period of time. And by the way, nobody can know who you are and you can't help anybody. Thank you. That has to be something that he has to learn to live with as well. And so that is the situation that I think, you know, I wanted to present him with. Yeah, you know, here's the world that he's moving into, and here are various, here are various viewpoints on that world coming at him, from the point of view of the farmers, from the point of view of Annalene and the people who are closer to nature there on Tatooine, and then the people who actually live in the nature, the Tuskens. I wanted to have all of them, interact with this man who is more than a catalyst. I mean, he ends up getting involved here by the end against his better judgment. But he is able, at least in Annalene's case, to help bring her through a crisis similar to the crisis he's had, which is that of losing everything after having the rug completely pulled out from under you. He's able to do something for her. He doesn't do it perfectly. He doesn't do it, the ideal way. He just doesn't have time to do it any better. And again, Ayark as well, I think, is impacted by Obi-Wan and, shown that, they don't need to keep waiting for a messiah. That was one of the things that I found while I was digging up stuff on the Tuskens, was that it was multiple times they've ended up playing host to a Jedi. At least three times that I was able to count where you had a Jedi with the Tuskens, and that occurred to me that, well, maybe there's something endemic to their culture that they go out looking for a hero, or they tend to find outsiders to rule them. That's not uncommon, necessarily, even on Earth's history. The Russia was founded when the locals invited the Vikings in to be their king, 1,000 years ago, because they needed a strong leader. That I figured would be something that they would be struggling with, and they would be looking at Ben first as a possible threat, and then as, are you the person that was that's going to, was promised to get us out of this mess that we're living in? Ben has that invitation from them, and he has to think about it.
I think you might have sort of answered this already, but how much did you confer with Del Rey regarding the time frame of the book, and then also with the little nods to other stories in canon that you had in there, like with Ciri and Satine?
Well, as far as the time frame of the book, that was established in my initial pitch, because I knew it was going to be, we were going to see just a handful of days. In fact, I went through and counted, it is actually only 10 days that we are shown. But there are stretches of time in between some of those days. And in fact, there are some slow portions in the book that are there on purpose, because I want you, the reader, to feel what Annalene was feeling without Ben around, what Ben was feeling not having gone and talked to anybody for days at a time. I had already figured where I wanted to put it, and you know, by the time I got around to writing it at the end of 2012, you know, all this new material had come in, I needed to negotiate around and make sure that everything, fit. The real book on this whole thing is The Life and Legend of Obi-Wan Kenobi, which was that Scholastic book that writer Wyndham did. And the entire Kenobi novel takes place during one line on one of the pages in the book. I can't remember what page it was, 110 or something like that. But it was a page where it describes that Ben Kenobi, after having moved from the location close to the Skywalker home, he moves further away, and he spends, and it refers to many months learning to live out in the middle of nowhere. And so, I parked the story there, was able to see from that put it definitely before Dark Lord and where, Obi-Wan finds out that Darth Vader is alive. So he's got that. Dark Lord also gives us the fact that Qui-Gon isn't talking to him yet. That ended up connecting back to, if we want to talk about something where, it really did come from interaction and advice from Lucasfilm and Del Rey, that's one of them right there, where in the beginning, when it was a graphic novel, there weren't going to be these interludes with Ben, where he was going to be talking to Qui-Gon. There was really no mechanism in comics to do that, a really long soliloquy like that, other than to just put caption boxes over him while he's in the middle of a scene. I just didn't think about doing that because that wasn't, the conceit of the novel or a graphic novel was going to be that we wouldn't get to hear from him. But once we got to the novel, and I think the idea actually came from Jennifer Heddle, was, let's just try, some of these, monologues, and see how they feel. And if they don't work, we'll take them out. And if they do work, we'll leave them in. And I started writing them and I realized, oh my gosh, this is the, this is the emotional heart of the book. There are a couple of moments that are like that for me where I get to that moment in the book and I say, okay, this is the moment I was trying to get to. But these moments with Obi-Wan where we see into his thinking and his mind and his feelings, I think these are the things I think the fact that we don't have Obi-Wan, we're not in his head on every single page, makes what we get from him more valuable and more meaningful. If you think about it, if he was going, page after page after page, considering or worrying about the Republic or, lamenting what has happened to his life and his friends and everything else, that would be pretty ponderous. And I think a little of it goes a long way. I think it's much more fun to show him trying to steel himself in these public situations where he's at, and put on a happy face when he needs to, when we, the reader, know what he's going through. I think that, yes, what we tried to do here with the points of view it's a lot more it's not the easiest path. It's a lot more difficult. In the Olympics, we would say there's a higher difficulty rating on this jump. But I think that it worked out. And, I think if the book is polarizing at all, it's going to be between the people that accept what we're trying to do here and the folks that, were looking for something just straightforward. But my hunch is that those people were also looking for, Sith bounty hunters to show up or something like that, lightsaber battles all the time, space battles. They were looking for Ben to leave Tatooine. That's not going to happen. This man is in jail. I realized the other day that he's in jail exactly the same amount of time He's trapped on Tatooine exactly the same amount of time that Andy Dufresne is trapped in Shawshank Prison. It's that, and he doesn't know yet. He doesn't know how long he's going to be here. And he's got to be thinking, was this the right move? So I think it does undercut to a degree, you know, his punishment, his penance, his whatever it is he's doing out here, to, you know, really offer him too much in the way of a respite from the place. And certainly I think it really is a strike against his mission here. I think Ben he'd rather leave Luke Skywalker, baby Luke, in a parked car with the engine running someplace, rather than go off and run back to Coruscant for something. It's just about the same thing. He knows he's the only person he can trust here.
Yeah, well, the end. I was reading this. I was finishing up this book at my mom's house, and when I got to the end, I had to rub my eyes really quickly because I didn't want my mom looking at me and going, "Why are you crying?"
Oh gosh. Well, I'm pleased that it spoke to you.
Well, there were several parts, but the last line especially it got me.
Well, and go back and read. It's the first line too.
Now I have to reread it. Darn. And there was another part that made me cry too, and it was when Obi-Wan and Annalene are having the conversation in his hut, and she's basically saying, "Do you think you're the first person to come from off-world?" And I can't remember the exact wording.
We got the really cute line I wish I could take credit for this as intentional, but it was totally accidental where she says something along the lines of, that's it. You think little Annie gets bored here, and then the first time somebody from off-world comes along, it's off to the races.
Yes.
And of course, Annie, Anakin, Qui-Gon, pod races, totally accidental.
Yeah,
But yeah, I think there's another couple of lines like that where she's responding to, he's broken, but she's broken too, and they're trying to work their way through this.
So did you pick her name specifically just to hurt all of us who are reading it, or was that completely coincidental?
No, it was entirely coincidental. And in fact, the first go round, I did not consider it. I think that a lot of the stuff that is in this book is stuff I would not have been capable of 6 years ago. I've written enough prose since then. There's just a lot of nuance that you can do in prose that you can't really do so well on the comics page. A lot of the time you try to do something subtle and something just doesn't work right because, there's all the various kinds of alchemy there that we have multiple people working at the same time. But I do think that that is just one of several things like a Yark's gender. I changed the Oren's family was originally going to be three characters, all boys, and I decided it would be better if he had a son and a daughter to mirror what Annalene had. I decided to, if one of the characters was going to be a complete mess, I decided that I would invest all of that in Vika and give her more of a tragic story because she's the surviving twin. But it's one of those things like with the Tusken Raiders. While we understand why she is the way she is, we don't give her a break because of that, or we shouldn't forgive the way that she is because of that. But again, these are the kinds of things I just probably was not thinking of back 6 years ago, and I think I got to it now.
Well, to borrow a saying from TV Tropes, I think we'll just go ahead and call that authorial fridge brilliance.
Well, it's, as long as it's not nuking the fridge, but okay. Yeah, yeah, no, there are a few things like that where I look at it and I say, often I've done the hand wave and it's been, oh yeah, I intended to do that, of course. but no, that's that one was the force.
So I have a little question about one little moment in one little scene. It's where Annalene is telling Ben at his little hermit shack the story of the Hollow Star who got lost in the desert. Mm-hmm. Now, you've said in the past that this is a story of how Obi-Wan became crazy old Ben. Was the scene where he pulls back his hood after hearing that story and look up to the skies, your little explanation about how physically he became crazy old Ben in such a relatively short amount of time?
It's an explanation.
Okay.
Well, no, I throw these things out as possible explanations. You know, the Ben Kenobi name, how it circulated, you know, that was something we were here to establish. And as far as how he gets older, well, anybody who's been out in you know, a really, you know, harsh climate. I mean, certainly me moving from down south up to Wisconsin for 20 years. Yeah, I've felt it and I've seen it in the mirror. I can tell the winters have been rough. Usually by the spring, I can just see it. And so, yeah, I think that's entirely, you know, what I was going for there. You know, whether there's something else that's going on, you know, that's aging him, you know, overnight. We don't do anything like that in this story, but you know, we certainly lay the groundwork that if you like that explanation, it works.
One of the things I really liked about the book was that redemption was one of the big themes, and that, like you said before, with the Tusken Raiders, they're not, you know, they're not sympathetic, but really, there's no one in this book that I could really qualify as a villain. Like, yes, Oren kind of, you would classify him as the antagonist, but I think there's still a lot about him that he thinks he's doing the right thing.
Everybody does.
Yeah, so how did you approach that sort of theme, especially when it came to what had just happened with Obi-Wan and Anakin?
Well, nobody is a villain in his own mind. With a few exceptions. I think when I wrote Lost Tribe of the Sith Spiral, where we had Baron Drapa, you know, he was an old school Sith. I decided to make him a knuckle dragging crazy, you know, the drooling evil guy that is in the Saturday morning serial, you know, things of old. But no, I wanted everybody in this book to basically, you know, have their objectives and just have them collide. Of course, in Oren's case, he does believe he's trying to redeem all of his, you know, past failures and his great ideas with that one big success. You know, there's a bit of a death of the salesman kind of thing going on there. Once everything falls apart for him, it falls apart very fast. But the other thing that we find out with him is that, you know, he's an example of the, you know, the morally malleable kind of person out there that will make the Empire thrive for a good long while. There have to be those kinds of people in every society, you know, willing to look the other way when something bad is happening or willing to profit from it. And it really feels to me, you know, particularly when we have that scene there where he's, you know, rallying the troops to go out and you know, go out into the wilderness to chase Ben, you know, that he's got the chops to, you know, in another life, you know, he could have been, you know, his own sort of mini, you know, mini emperor figure, at least in this very small scale. He's got that ability to smile and move people and get them to do his bidding. And that really is the whole challenge with the Sith running anything, is how do you get all these people to do your bidding with people who, you know, are magnetic in that way and can do things. Ben does say in there, though, that, I mean, this is not about redemption for him, because really, you know, it's he cannot replace the Republic. He cannot undo what he has done to Anakin by helping a few people out in the desert. He, you know, can, however, make it more possible for him to do what he needs to do to get to that moment. He can you know, find ways to make Luke more secure. He can find ways to make it easier for him to go to bed at night and not go crazy by getting some sort of a hermit work-life balance going on, and learning to deal. And so yeah, I think he, of all of the characters, Obi-Wan is the most philosophically sophisticated. He is the most aware of what he's doing. He is the one who is most questioning why he is doing what he's doing. And we get these moments in the middle of the book where he's going, okay, I should not be here. I'm here for the wrong reasons. How often in life have we been, you know, in situations for what we know is, a selfish reason or the wrong reason? He knows that, this is not the way to resolve his personal issues and to protect the future of the galaxy. He's got to sort of, over the course of the next 18, 19 years, surrender his ego and, become the great master that he's going to have to be.
Okay, so this is fairly minor, but around here, I'm sort of the Alderaan person. At the end of the book, Annalene finally gets to go off and do the zoological program with the University of Alderaan. Can you please reassure us that her and the two kids were not on Alderaan when it goes boom?
Well, you saw him. You saw him make the joke. Alderaan's still there, isn't it?
Yes, that was like a knife to my heart, but
that was on purpose. Remember, it's also said that it's an off-world branch of the university, so you can read into it that she isn't. It's also only a 2-year program, so you can read that into it as well. You can also read into that the story might not be done. When I wrote this novel, I had absolutely no intention of following it up with anything. I not wrote the novel. I came up with a story. The intention was that it was a standalone story. It does stand alone, but having finished it, the random person can look at it and see avenues that could be pursued if anybody was interested in doing it. And I want to see what the response to the book is, and we'll just leave it at that.
Well, that answers a question from a listener who wanted to know if there was any chance of a sequel to Kenobi.
That is largely a function of circumstances that will be way out of my control. Sales, what's going on with later episodes, that sort of thing. I'm always happy to write more. But I'm also always happy to, if I see something that looks good as it is and it doesn't need to be embellished on, I'm also happy to leave that alone, too. I feel better about Kenobi than anything I've ever written. And I, certainly would hesitate to mess with that. But at the same time, you never say never. And, if enough time passes, who knows?
Well, the other book you have out now is Overdraft, The Orion Offensive. And I read that when it was serialized, and I really, really enjoyed it.
I appreciated all the promo plugs you gave to it. That was a fun experience. And of course, it's now out in both physical copies and digital all around the world. And over the next couple of months, it's going to start appearing in the systems at Barnes & Noble and all the other booksellers are out there. It was a fun. I wrote it consecutively. As soon as I got done with Kenobi, I wrote it straight out. So really, for the last 6 weeks, I haven't been doing a lot. that was 225,000 words in a row right there. So it was a lot of fun. And again, playing in my own sandbox, that was completely new to me.
Yeah, and I'm kind of upset that no one else is going to be able to have to go through the serialized experience, because every time I got to the end of a chapter, I cursed you on Twitter because I wanted the next part now.
It's an interesting dynamic putting the book out that way. We say at the end of the book that the characters will return.
Yes, I'm excited.
I have not actually formed up or firmed up where that's going to take place or how. It's one of those things where I'm going to have to look at my own schedule and some other things that I've got going on, because, in addition to, the licenses that you're aware of, then I've got, I'm right now in the middle of a Star Trek novella that I'm writing. And I also have out there, I've had my own Project X, which is sort of the grand unification theory style work of my own that's going to bring together most of the things that I'm really interested in writing about. Science fiction, my own series, separate and apart from Overdraft, which I'll continue to do. I enjoyed it. It's fun. And it's meant to be, that kind of, popcorn, pulp fiction, serial style story. Whether it comes back as a serial or as a completed work or as a novella or something like that will entirely depend on all these other things that I've got spinning at the same time. Certainly the serial created a number of dynamics that are unusual. The cliffhangers at the end of each story, I would want to look at those and say, well, maybe I know what the cliffhangers did to you, but there were a lot of other people that were bothered by them, and if people had complaints about the serial process, it was because they were not accustomed to reading serials. They weren't accustomed to comic books have been the standard bearer of serialized fiction, for many, many years, in print. But on TV, you really only got them in the soap operas. It wasn't until, you got to the late night soaps, in the 1980s, late 70s, 1980s, 1990s, that people began to get used to the notion that, okay, this is not one episode of a series. This is one long, ongoing story, and we're going to have cliffhangers at the end of each episode. But even then, even today, people structure episodes of TV series so that they're really still a completed story or a completed whole. We're not just dividing right at the middle of the peak of the action like we do in comics all the time. And so that was a bit of a challenge writing the story anyway, is I wanted to try to give enough meat to the storyline that, I was developing overall, and yet at the same time setting up these individual episodic cliffhangers that were going there in between. I think it was interesting to do in prose, and I'm open to doing it again, but I think if I did it again, I would want to get done with the book completely in advance. Because I was actually writing some episodes while the episodes were coming out.
Wow.
And that's okay in comics, because comics don't take as long to write. But this is another story.
So we've got one last question from a reader and listener. Richard Elliott Preston wants to know, Is there going to be a Tusken Raider cosplay club for next year's San Diego Comic-Con you'll be joining?
Okay, yes, thank you, Richard. I saw that tweet. I am absolutely aware of my limitations, and I believe in leaving things to the pros, whoever the pros are, even if those pros are fans who are knowledgeable about the ways of costuming. I am not. My one costume experience was back at my first convention, and it was so horrible. I fear to even tell the story again. So basically, it takes more than a hat and a gun to make Indiana Jones. and I just, that just wasn't me. So I know where my boundaries are, and But I'm thrilled that there's so many people out there that love, dressing up with these characters, and I ended up grabbing a poor Tusken Raider out of the aisle in San Diego Comic-Con and dragging him back to the booth to stand guard while I was doing the signing. He thought it was awesome, and I thought it was cool too. But that is. It's like I was saying earlier about comics and everybody looking for a way to get involved. That's a way for people to get involved without necessarily getting a book contract. It is a level on which that you can participate. Doing podcasts, doing websites, and I think that just makes it richer for all of us. But no, certainly I'm not going to be dressing up as anything. I will wear the little badges for the 501st and the Rebel Legion, but that's about it. I just can't imagine wearing a Mandalorian outfit and trying to get into an elevator. It's just not going to happen.
So if you were in a Tusken outfit, it would be kind of like Oren at the end of the book.
Well, yeah, and yeah, that's poor Oren.
That's a fate that's, worse than death, by the way.
It is the worst thing I've ever done to a character, and I like him, and I like him even though I'm not supposed to like him,
he's very charismatic.
Well, yeah, and I know one reader thought he was so charismatic he did not see the fall coming, and I said reread it because it is literally littered with signs that this guy is not your friend, or that he's lying to himself about a long number of things or a large number of things, but yeah, it is a rough way to go, and he's still alive too, so we'll see what happens with him.
All right, well, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us. We really all enjoyed Kenobi, and we're looking forward to everyone else reading it so we can actually talk about it. Where can people find you online?
People can find me on Twitter at JJMFaraway. That is my handle on there. Facebook, it's just John Jackson Miller after the Facebook.com, John Jackson Miller. The Amazon homepage for all of my stuff, amzn.to/JJ Miller. Goodreads is goodreads.com/John Jackson Miller. My website is farawaypress.com. I've got behind the scenes pieces on just about everything I've ever done, depending on whether I've had time to actually get the things up there. And I'll be doing a behind the scenes page on Kenobi at some point where I'll reveal whatever trivia has not been revealed in the past. Also where, people, who I saw as the various characters, I'll get into that on there. The whole dream casting kind of thing. Two guesses who, exactly two guesses on who I would cast as Obi-Wan Kenobi. although there's a third person who wants to be his voice, and maybe a fourth. So there we go with that. And then I continue to run my Comicron.com, comics research site when there's any time left, and there really hasn't been much lately.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming on. We're really looking forward to getting this interview out to our listeners because it was an absolute blast.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. So long, and thank you again.
Thanks.
All right.
We'd like to thank John Jackson Miller for coming on to the show and doing that interview with us. We had an absolute blast. recording with him and discussing Kenobi. And like we said at the start of this episode, if you haven't purchased this book yet, go do so. I don't know why you got to this point in the show if you hadn't already purchased it.
Or read it.
Yeah, exactly. So
this is the point where an announcer would say, if you buy one EU book ever, buy Kenobi.
If you buy one EU book, make it Kenobi by John Jackson Miller. On bookshelves, August 27th.
Yes, exactly like that.
Just like that. Yeah, we love the book. It's going to be a regular reread for us. And speaking of the book,
I'm holding it in my hand.
We are. We've got a lovely promotional copy here. Nancy's modeling it for me, kind of like Bob Barker's...
Barker's Beauties.
Barker's Beauties, yes.
Vanna White.
Yes, Vanna White, yes. So she's holding the book. We've got a copy here provided to us courtesy of Random House. Thank you to Greg QB there for getting that to us. And we are going to give it away.
Why would we do something like that?
Because we love you, our loyal, loyal listeners.
Also, because we want to help get people into the expanded universe.
We do, because this... is a great intro.
Yes.
Book.
It's a great introduction to the expanded universe. And it makes me wish that there was someone or a group of people knowledgeable about Star Wars who could give some sort of discussion on how to get people into the expanded universe, say at a convention. Maybe a science fiction and fantasy convention happening in Atlanta, Georgia.
Wait a minute. I think I got something.
What?
In Atlanta, this week, is a convention called Dragon Con.
Dragon Con? Never heard of it.
Dragon Con. Yes, it is a nerd convention, a science fiction, fantasy, you name it, convention. And there is a Star Wars fan track there. And at this Star Wars fan track is a panel called Intro to the Expanded Universe, featuring Tom Hutchins... Aaron Goins
Star Wars Bookworms.
Star Wars Bookworms. I apologize, Aaron and Teresa. I just had a complete brain meltdown for a moment. It's been a long weekend.
I believe Daniel Eisenhower.
Actually, let me go pull up that email. There's a couple other names there.
And Brian and me.
Yes, Brian and Nancy from Tosche Station Radio. So, yes, that panel will be there. And if you go to that panel because you couldn't get in to see Billy Dee Williams in time, oh well, we have a copy of Kenobi by John Jackson Miller that we are giving away to one person in the audience. And correct me if I'm wrong, but we've got another book we're going to be giving away during this panel.
Yes, I believe we also have the Essential Reader's Companion, which is going to be our required reading for the course.
Yes, we are structuring this panel
like a college course, and we have a syllabus.
But it won't be as dry because we will inject some humor and, you know, hey, it's us.
Yeah. Hey. It's me.
So yes, we've got a copy of Kenobi and a copy of the Essential Reader's Companion that we will be giving away at this panel. We've got some other material.
Yep, but I don't know what. And
well, we've got a box of books that Random House has given us that we've been trying to give away.
We have two other panels, too, we're on at DragonCon.
Yes, and I'm thinking we might give away some other books at those panels, so stay tuned to the blog. We'll have details there.
Yes.
But definitely show up to Intro to the Expanded Universe, where we'll be giving away Kenobi and the Essential Reader's Companion.
We'll also be on the blogs, podcasting, fanfiction, vidding, etc. panel with other podcasters and bloggers like Brian Young, Riley and Bethany Blanton, and Davenport, other people. There's several people on that panel. So we'll basically be talking about running Star Wars sites and being involved in the community and Episode 7 and how that's changed everything.
In other words, it might be a panel full of wailing and gnashing of teeth. No. It'll be a fun one. There's some great guests there that you should come check out, us included. We might have a couple more books to give away, and we'll definitely have some Tosche Station branded swag for you.
Yes, and we will also be doing the Women and Minorities panel.
And this one I'm really excited for.
Yeah, we've got a lot of good people on the panel, like Amy Radcliffe, who was on the show a few weeks ago, and also staff writer Bria will be coming to Dragon Con.
Yes, we just found out this morning, Sunday morning, that staff writer Bria is going to be able to go to Dragon Con and will be sitting in on that panel with us, and we're very, very excited about it. I know what book to give away at that one.
What?
We've got a copy of Knight Errant. Or not Knight Errant. Dawn of the Jedi Into the Void.
Oh, we
by
do.
Tim Levin. We will bring that with us, and we will give that one away at the Women and Minorities in Star Wars panel.
That's a good idea.
It's topical.
Yes, indeed. Too bad we don't have Razor's Edge yet.
That really is too bad.
Yeah, because that would be a good one.
Well, speaking of Razor's Edge, I'm about 33% of the way done with the book. Really, really enjoying it.
Yay, that's good.
Yeah, very, very excited about this Rebellion series. But we'll have more of that in our next episode. I think, will we be back next week?
Maybe
next week we will definitely have some recorded material from Dragon Con.
Yeah, we might have that the first week back just to give us a chance to relax after 2 weekends away. I know you're all playing your tiny violins for us, but we're anxious to get back to normality. At least we will be after Dragon Con.
Yes.
We're looking forward to nerd fun.
Yeah, we're looking for a way to record the panels we'll be on, and something we may do next week is release one of those panels as a downloadable mini-episode.
Yes, that would, yeah, we'll do that. And hopefully we might be able to chat with some people at Dragon Con. We'll see.
Yeah,
record a Tashi Station After Dark episode.
Well, we'll see about that one. But yeah, there's some cool people, and if you're a member of the Star Wars fan community, either you're just a fan or you run a blog, podcast, something like that, come track us down. We'd like to have you sit in with us and chat.
Give you a wristband.
Yes, give you a wristband, chat, shove a microphone in your face because we are bringing the studio with us.
Yep. Which is why we should record a podcast.
It is. And now that we've got Bria there, we're definitely going to have to do something.
Yeah.
So yes, Dragon Con, if you were...
And speaking of Bria, wasn't her and Emily's podcast wonderful?
It was. It was fantastic. And if you think they should do a monthly show...
You should tweet them and tell them that.
And tell us.
At KSBria and at Car Kick Store, C-A-R-R.
Yes, if you liked what you heard, we would love to make that a monthly show. We just have to convince them to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got a little mixer I can give Bria at DragonCon to take home, but you guys got until then to convince them to do this.
I think it would be fun.
I mean, yeah, it would be great. I'd love it. A great addition to the blog. So tell them, email us, and we'll send that to them.
I don't know if there are any podcasts that are just... I don't know if there are any Star Wars-centric podcasts that are just women. There are, I don't know about it. I know that Big Shiny Robot has the Big Shiny Girl cast, but I believe it's more general geekdom.
Yeah, I can't think of one. I'm sure there may be one out there I just don't know about.
We might have to challenge them with this.
Oh, if we challenge those two with this.
Challenge accepted.
So yes, if you liked what you heard, let them know that we'd love to be able to have them do a monthly podcast.
I'm beginning to regret this, knowing that Bria will be in physical proximity with me next weekend.
She'll take out her anger on me more than you.
I'm sorry, Bria.
Sorry, Bria. But if you liked what you heard, let them know that so we can kind of prod them into doing a show, because I really, really liked it, and if we can talk them into it, we will be getting them some equipment to increase the production value of the show and to make it a regular thing.
Yep.
So, I think that's enough for one day, because we gotta get geared up for Dragon Con now.
And you were here for John Jackson Miller, not us.
Exactly. Anyway. So, folks, we will catch you next time. You know what? I don't even have the usual outro notes up. On Twitter, you can find us with the handles at Tashi_Station. That's the official show account. You can find Nancy with at Nancy Pants. That's Nancy with an I. You can find me with at Lane Winree, LaneWinree. On Facebook, we are the Tashi Station Network. If we are available in the iTunes store, if you like what you hear, please do leave a review. It helps us grow the show. You can find our columns and news at Tashi-Station.net. We have been brought to you today by Her Universe and Audible.com. Check out the links on the blog to help keep the lights on. Thanks for listening to another episode, and if you're going to Dragon Con, we'll see you there.
May the Force be with you.
This podcast has been brought to you by Majestic Giraffe Productions and is the official podcast of TashiStation.net. All Star Wars names, music, and logos are property of their respective trademark and copyright holders. Tashi Station Radio is not endorsed by Lucasfilm or any division of the company. Now go pick up some power converters.